Hello and welcome to Catalyst Happy Hour-ish with me, Anthony.
And me, Darren.
And today, Darren and I are very excited because we have a very special guest. We have Simon Thomas with us. Thank you for being here.
Chaps, hello. How are you?
We are very well and we're very excited. We're very excited for this.
And also nervous.
Why are you nervous?
Well, it's just, you know, we've interviewed how many, is it about, should we say three famous people now? This will be the third.
Depends if you want to count your wife in the famous category, Darren.
Well, she's going to listen to this now. So, yeah, she is the most famous and most important person in the entire world.
Where will I have seen her?
She does counselling for young people, so probably not at all.
that's far more important than anything I've ever done.
We've had three guests, really, and that have been from, you know, BBC or music and things like that. So it's cool to have another scope in that direction, which is really awesome. And yeah, hopefully we'll have quite a good conversation and be able to answer any questions people might have about you personally or the job you were in and things like that. So yeah.
No, we'll fire away. I'm very happy to answer pretty much anything.
Excellent. That is good to know. But before we do that, if you do have any questions about today's podcast or any comments you want to send us, you can get us at info@catalystyouth.org.uk. Or if you want to email myself or Darren personally, it's Anthony or Darren@catalystyouth.org.uk. And our website is www.catalystyouth.org.uk, where you can find our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and so much more. So we're used to saying that now, Darren.
That's lovely. You probably do that in your sleep, don't you?
We keep saying every time we need to just record that and just edit it in each time, really.
Just slap it in.
Well, I said we should get like a voiceover, like a Morgan Freeman kind of intro, because that would be
cool. Can you imagine?
His voice is just amazing. But yeah, so anyway.
it may cost you something. You may have to sell both houses.
Yeah, I mean, I was just sat there thinking, we went on a train yesterday and George has decided she wants to be the voiceover person, so maybe she can just come and do it for us for free. So,
I mean, she doesn't even listen to the podcast, mate. So, you know.
Yeah, she won't hear us say that. Perfect. Well, Darren, do you want to kick us off?
Yes, we'll go with the first question that we've got written down here. We usually, with all our guests that we've interviewed, we ask them just a warm-up question kind of thing. It's like an icebreaker, like we do with the young people when we're doing youth group or whatever. So the first question is what is your favourite movie?
Well, this is really funny, given the name you've just mentioned in respect of an unlikely and unaffordable voiceover. It's a film that features this man, Morgan Freeman. It's Shawshank Redemption. I realise that's a bit cliche, but it's one of the few films I can watch again and again and again and enjoy it as much as the first time I watched it. And it's a fairly brutal film in places for the young people watching it who've never seen it. It's a hard watch at times, but it's also, it's a remarkable film. I think it was never meant to, I don't think it went on mass release at first, and then it got picked up and grew into this film that so many others will cite as their favourite film. But, I mean, Morgan Freeman in it is brilliant. But I remember seeing, actually, it was only the other day, actually, someone used it as kind of an analogy for life, in that there's a very grim scene towards the end as Anson Dupre, the main character, tries to find his way out of the prison. And he finally he's built this tunnel that he's done over years and years with his tiny little pick in his room. And the last break for freedom involves smashing a hole in the sewage pipe that runs out of the prison. And he smashes it, and you can only begin to imagine the smell. And he has to crawl through this pipe surrounded by stuff I don't need to mention. Your imagination will do that. And eventually he falls into this stream and begins to walk away and finds his freedom. And I remember someone using this as an analogy, I think it was on Instagram the other week, saying that often in life, to get to a better place, to get to a place where we feel freer, we often have to go through the crap times, which is essentially he did that, but in a very different way. But yeah. I thought that was such a, it's so true for so much of life that, that in order for him, because he wasn't guilty, that's the heartbreak of the film. This guy loses so many years of his life over something he never did. And in the end, his only way to freedom is to break free and go through this awful pipe. And but it's a really good analogy for life. We go through very difficult times. Sometimes we have to crawl literally through the rubbish in order to get to the light, to get to freedom. So for me, it's the one film I could go back and watch it now. It's long. It's, I think it's 3+ hours, isn't it? But yeah. I could go and watch it now if I didn't have other things to do. And I know every bit that's coming, but I still love it.
Yeah, yeah. I did a 24-hour in prison to raise money for a charity.
Wow.
And in the chapel area, there was a choice between two movies. It was either The Shawshank Redemption or the one that
Great Escape?
No, it was the one in filmed in Wales, the comedy one. Wales, ooh. City of Wales.
Cardiff?
I can't think what the name of the film is.
It's like the worst Game of Thrones ever.
Like the greater good.
Hot Fuzz.
Hot Fuzz, that's the one. Fuzz. There was those two choices. And yeah. I was like, let's do Shawshank.
They're quite different films.
Because it's over 3 hours long and we don't have to go back into the cell for like ages then.
Yeah.
But no,
yeah.
They chose Hot Fuzz, didn't they? So
you were back in the cell.
Hour and a bit and we're back in the cells for the rest of the 24 hours.
If anyone wants to know more about that, evening, well, the night Darren spent in prison, head over to our YouTube. There is a little documentary thing on it.
Yes, there is. I mean, amazing film. I love that film.
I want to watch it again now because I haven't seen it in years.
Yeah. You'll enjoy it as much as the first time you watched it.
Yeah. Okay, perfectly. Well, we talk a lot about movies. We also talk a lot about music. So who would you say is your favourite artist, or what's your favourite album if you can pin it down to?
My favourite artist ever, band-wise, was Queen. Nice. I grew up when they were, let's give my age away a little bit, grew up when they were kind of in their pomp. I do remember watching it on TV. I watched their appearance at Live Aid in 1985. And if the young people watching this are going, Live Aid, what was that? Well, just go on YouTube, put in Live Aid, and put Queen in, you'll see this. Every band, however big they were, got 20 minutes on the nose. And if you went over your 20 minutes, they would literally turn the sound off. So you had to basically do this kind of jukebox of your best hits in 20 minutes. And Queen put together this performance that I remember watching. And I was 12 at the time, and just being mesmerized by this band, but also the figure of Freddie Mercury, who, I've read around a lot and about his life, an incredibly shy man with a lot of insecurities, and yet put him on a stage in front of 60, 70, 100,000 people, and he would have them in the palm of his hand. So I was always kind of interested in him as a character, interested in them as a band. I love their music, the variety and stuff. But I think, if you were going to say one album, I mean, it's very difficult to pick one of theirs. But I think the measure of it is how many times you listen to it. And there's one that came out in 2005. And again, for the young people watching, they go, God, that's so long ago. And they're still around. But Coldplay's X and Y album that came out in 2005 was one I just listened to again and again and again. The Fix You song was just an incredible song. Yeah. I've never quite understood why Coldplay are so Marmite. I think it's basically jealousy. I think people know they write just really, really good songs. They put on an amazing show. And some people think it's fashionable just to say, I don't like them, when probably deep down they go, no, that's... I think it's the same with Ed Sheeran now. I think an awful lot of people feel it's more trendy to not like Ed, even though deep down they know, flipping heck, the latest songs he's had out, it's a work of genius, but it's kind of trendy to say, I'm not an Ed Sheeran fan, and Coldplay are a tub thumpers, foot tapping band. But I think probably X and Y is one I could go back and listen to again and again and not get bored. I think it's like with a film. I think that's the measure of a good album is because you go back to it and listen to it and it still feels as fresh as the first time you listen to it.
Yeah, brilliant. I know for a fact my dad's going to hear this and go, no, I genuinely hate Coldplay.
Okay, well, as long as it's genuine and not just on trend, I'm happy to go with that.
With Queen, I mean, I think that Live Aid and their Wembley performance, I think are the most two popular go-to videos that the TV uses all the time.
Yeah.
And I remember watching obviously I was too young, I was only 4 when the Band Aid actually was on TV and performed. But it was an amazing performance. I've watched it on YouTube and absolutely amazing. And I said, didn't they also go over their time? Did they do an encore? No, they didn't do that
because that was set in stone. But what they did is their sound guy snuck in to the sound tent in the middle of Wembley Stadium. And if anyone's watched, you know, if you don't know anything about Queen, watch Bohemian Rhapsody, which will give you, it's an amazing film. But that bit in the film is true. Their sound guy snuck into the tent. Well, I think he was already in there just overseeing things. And when the main sound guy wasn't looking, because all the bands had their sound levels set the same. Obviously, you vary, you know, the mix and stuff. But in terms of volume, everyone was the same. When the guy wasn't looking, he moves the sticker and moved the volume dials up. So Queen were louder than any other band out there. But it's not just about loud, it's about the way they perform. But they did. There was a little bit of mischief amidst their performance.
No, that's brilliant. I mean, I love Queen. And you say you can't pick an album. I always cop out and pick the Greatest Hits Volume 1.
So... Well, I thought about that and thought that is, and you know, a cop out.
It is. Oh, but that's brilliant. That's brilliant. So, yeah. Okay. So, I mean, we're here to talk mainly about your life throughout the career you've had and things like that. And you're probably best known for children's TV, Blue Peter, things like that, as well as Sky Sports.
Yeah.
But what led you to get into TV as a career?
Good question. So I'll try and give you the pint size version. So I'd always watched Blue Peter as a kid. I loved it. I loved the spirit of adventure and everything in the show. And I don't think I ever went beyond watching it and going, you know, I'd love to work on that. Mm. But never in a million years did I think I would ever end up working on it. And I think really in terms of broadcasting and television, the kind of light bulb went on at university. I had a bit of an interest in kind of presenting. And when I went to Birmingham University, I was going around in Freshers Week, all the different societies, and there was one called Guild TV. So I sort of signed up, and they had basically within the Students Guild, a proper television studio. They'd basically got this secondhand equipment from these BBC studios called Pebble Mill that were down the road in Birmingham at the time, long gone. And so they built a proper studio with three cameras. They had a gallery where they controlled the vision and the sound. And after a time, I started presenting this program called The Lunchbox. Friday lunchtimes, went out on all the small televisions, there were no widescreen TVs in these days, in the Guild, in all the bars. Nobody watched it. It was on mute. But you got this experience of actually what a live TV studio is like. Okay, it's not the quality of what I went on to do, but the raw ingredients were there, having an earpiece, listening to a director, where I look at camera one, two, or three, and all those kind of things. And I just loved it. And as I left university in 95, I thought, I just want to do this. And I actually remember one of the girls who worked on it. And she said, you should do this as a career. And she said, do you know what you'd want to do? And I said, yeah, I've always wanted to do Blue Peter. So I came out of university. That was the goal. My parents were living in Suffolk at the time. And I remember going home and thinking, well, how do I go about getting this job? And I was about to make a showreel tape. I bought this book on how to become a TV presenter. And I was going to write to lots of different TV stations and companies about getting work experience, about getting in there, maybe being a runner, you know, just getting my foot in the door. I always said to people, that's the hardest bit. Get your foot in the door. Once your foot's in the door, you've got the chance to impress people and meet the right people. So I was all set to write all these letters, to go out with a colleague of my dad's from his church and make the showreel tape. And I thought to myself, I haven't really prayed about this. I'm kind of, because in my head I'd said 3 years, I give myself 3 years to make it. And I thought I probably should pray about this. So I sort of remember sitting down, it was kind of mid-July, very hot day in Suffolk. And sat in my room and just prayed. And I was quite direct with my prayer. And I just said, God, just give me a sign that this is the way you want me to go in life. Because I don't want to waste the next 3 years of my life chasing something that you're not in. And kind of said, amen. And waited my dad to go out. And then I sat down at his desk, a little bit like where I am now, slightly older version of the iMac I'm looking at you on. But his old Apple Macintosh. And was just about to start writing these letters. I had a long list of TV companies I was going to write to. And I just saw these magazines to the left, a little pile of my dad's Christian magazines. And there was one magazine on top. And to this day, I can't remember which magazine it was, but a fairly well-known one at the time. And on the kind of side headlines of the articles inside was this one that said, why we need more Christians in the media. I was like, wow. So I sort of feverishly went to page 64, wherever it was. And there was this article by a guy called Steve Chalk, who I ended up working for a little while, a woman called Pam Rhodes, who was presenting Songs of Praise at the time. And it was like one of those moments, I don't know if the young people watching have ever been in church or at a youth meeting, wherever it might be, and someone speaks from the front, and it feels in that moment like this message you're hearing was just meant for you. Yeah. And it felt like this article had been written just for me. And it was like the green light. And in the end, through sort of working in Selfridges in London for 2 years to pay the bills while I was in London, I did a runner's job at a London radio station with LBC. I started being a runner at Children's BBC at weekends. Amidst that, I applied for Blue Peter twice and got nothing more back than a letter saying, we'll keep your details on file. If you know what those kind of letters means, it basically means a polite way of saying no. And I'd kind of got to about sort of 1998, and I'd given up. So I was working actually for Steve Chalk at the Oasis Trust at the time. I'd kind of given up on the TV dream. And then something happened where, there's a famous story at the time, one of their presenters was sacked for using drugs, a guy called Richard Bacon. So the door was open and someone in the office said, you should give it one last go. And I did. And it was a very long process because they wanted to make sure they had the right person, given there was so much publicity about the departure of Richard. And somehow, 3.5 years after I'd said that prayer back in Suffolk, I landed the job. But it was a long old process. There were times where I just thought it's never going to happen. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, it happens.
Yeah, that's so good. And I mean, it's brilliant to hear how that message of just getting your foot in the door, that is the first step, you know, meeting those people, having those conversations, being able to build up from there. But also how there is that message for you. The fact that you had that magazine there does show that actually that was the calling that you were going towards.
Yeah.
And I mean, I grew up watching Blue Peter. When you were presenting, that shows my age. So
that shows my age. Because when I bump into mums and dads who've got two kids in tow and they say, I grew up watching you, I'm like, flip me.
Yeah.
Really?
But it was that moment of hesitation where I was like, do I mention that bit? It's like, no, I'm getting it.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm very glad to have played a small part in your childhood.
Yeah.
But also with the, you know, you praying and waiting 3 years before actually getting to Blue Peter also just shows that it's in God's timing and not our timing.
Yeah.
You know, we want things to happen now or, you know, tomorrow morning, please, if possible.
Yeah.
But actually there is a plan and that it may take 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, just work hard and get to that point because it, you know, if it's in God's plan, it will happen.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah, it's so true. And so often you can't see that at the time. Mm. You know, for some people in life, something will happen very, very quickly. Like Matt Baker, who I presented with for most of my time on the program, you know, Matt saw an opening, had never thought about doing this before, made a showreel tape. And I think 2 weeks later, he was Blue Peter presenter number 28. And I remember looking on at the time saying, that took me 3.5 years. It's taking you 3 minutes. But, you know, often in life, you know, for most people, it doesn't happen like that. And it's about perseverance. It's about hanging in there. And sometimes we can get really frustrated with God's time because we don't understand it. As you know, you say, Darren, you know, we want it now.
Yeah.
You know, we're in an instant culture where we want stuff now, but sometimes God's timing is very different. And it's actually only when you look back on, as I look back talking to you guys now in that period of life, you can actually see, well, God was in it. And it actually was right to wait that long because it prepared me for something that was so life-changing.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, that's one of the things that I think we interviewed Bronwyn, who, what was she, production manager for?
Planet Earth. Not Blue Planet, as we kept saying.
Yeah. No. Get in trouble for that one again. But she's saying that that's where she started. She started as a runner and worked her way up to where she is today. And she said for people to get into it, literally, that's the way to go.
Yeah, no, it is.
It's about, you know, gaining that experience before getting that big role that you really want. You know,
exactly.
You need a bit of life experience. So what about Sky Sports then? What took you to, you know, leaving Blue Peter to going over to Sky Sports?
Well, I knew when I got the job on Blue Peter that it's not a job for life. You know, you're not going to be there picking up your pension when you're 65, let's be honest. You know, you have a shelf life, but also it's a job that for the 6 years that I did it essentially does take over your life. And, you know, I think because it takes so much of your life up and, you know, impinges on your ability to, you know, be at various life events, like having to miss friends' weddings because you're away filming and stuff. I think in order to remain fresh as a presenter, you can't do it forever. So 5-6 years was about the kind of the average time people were staying on it when I was on it. So I knew from the start, this is not a job for life. And also I knew I didn't take anything for granted. I remember quite a number of people, both people who knew and people who didn't know, saying when I got the job, oh, yeah, you know, you're made for life now. You know, there'll be, you know, you'll go on to do so many different things. This is such a good springboard. And I never really believed that because I think because it had been such a long period waiting to get the job that I never assumed that just because I'd got this job, that equals there'll be offers flying in when I decide to leave. And actually, when I did leave, I had no offers. I remember vividly being sat in the pub the day after I left in 2005 and just left this most amazing job, and I felt it was important to leave on a high so that you don't leave with any kind of regrets or the program sort of ground you down because of it taking your life over. So leaving on a high is really hard. But I remember sat in the pub the next day going, crikey, right now I was with a mate, I've got a job and I've just been in the best job in the world. But I was very clear early on that the next place I wanted to go was sport. I love sport, and I knew that I would have the raw presenting skills available to do live TV, to interview people, to do pre-recorded stuff. So I had the raw skills, but in order to move into sport, I would have to learn a new set of skills. So I was very determined right from the word go that that's where I wanted to go. And I did a lot of sports films for Blue Peter. I worked a bit for BBC Sport towards the end. And everything was looking good to move into BBC Sport. And I was very honest with them and said, look, I'll start wherever. I think probably, without being arrogant, I don't want to be a runner, but I'm prepared to go out and do match reports, you know, around the country in the week, you know, football league games, wherever. I didn't expect to walk in at match of the day or football focus level. And the BBC basically weren't willing to take a gamble on a kids presenter. And I was told by the head of sport at the time, we don't see kids presenters working in BBC Sport. So I was left with nowhere to go there, and went to see Sky in the end with my agent, and they were much more open-minded. Yeah. And they said, look, you're going to need to start on sort of Sky Sports News. And if your dream is one day presenting the football, you're going to have to work your way up. And I was happy with that. This was the chance that I was being given. So 2005, around June, July time, Sky said, come on board. So I did. And, you know, again, that was a period of perseverance. I love doing Sky Sports News, don't get me wrong, but my dream, like so many who walk into the gates of Sky and Isleworth, was ending up doing live football, which I eventually did. But that, again, was a good 5 years before that began to happen.
Okay. Wow. I mean, it's brilliant to hear your journey through it, because it is all about perseverance. And I think that is a key thing to know in today's day and age, that actually it is about working towards something. It is about being patient and being able to progress that way, which is really cool. But you've obviously done so much throughout those jobs, but do you have a particular favorite moment of your career?
Oh gosh, I mean, when it comes to Blue Peter, it's so difficult to pick out. I think the one I tell the most often, because it was one of those kind of surreal moments, when I loved all the travel, the daredevil stuff, the skydiving, the abseiling out of the back of a Chinook helicopter. You know, there's so many experiences, but the one that I often look back and it just sort of makes me smile is that as part of the Queen's Golden Jubilee, she came to visit BBC Television Centre, and the only two programmes she was going to visit was BBC News and Blue Peter. So they invited to the Blue Peter studio the great and the good from the past. So some of the old presenters were there, the likes of Peter Purvis and Barry Singleton. There were ex-Blue Peter editors there. And so the studio had been set up, and they were going to film it live, but she came in before the live programme and then put it into the show later that day. So we had this long lineup in the studio, and the idea is the Queen would come in, and the then editor of the programme, Steve Hocking, would introduce the Queen to the various presenters past and present. And they said that I would be the one who would be on the end of the line and would give the Queen a gold Blue Peter badge. And they'd given me that responsibility because they said, you are the least likely of the four presenters to mess your lines up, because they recognised that meeting the Queen is quite a big deal. And before she arrived, about half an hour before, her press woman came in, very I'm trying to put this diplomatically, quite a strong character, shall we say, which is why she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah.
And she came along the line and she arrived at me and said, right, what are you going to say to the Queen? And I said, well, I've got a bit of a gag. And she said, the Queen doesn't do gags. What are you saying? So I gave her the lines and she said, you cannot say that. He said, I'll be back in 5 minutes, think of something different. So I'm like, oh, well, I've been working this for ages. So my editor came over and he said, well, what can we say? And as we're talking, this haughty woman comes back and says, if you stick to those words, you can say it. And I was like, right, okay. And then half an hour later, in comes the Queen. And, you know, I don't know whether anyone watching or listening to this has been in the presence of the Queen, whether it's at some event or not. It's a really surreal moment because for all of us, and I'm pretty sure there's probably no one probably listening or watching to this who's older than the Queen. For all of us, she's been an ever-present in our lives. Mm. She has been part of the life of this nation throughout the time all of us have been alive. And, you know, whether you're a royalist or not, I think when she eventually goes, she's going to leave a massive hole. But when she walked in, you feel like you know her. It's like you feel like she's your grandma because she's always been there.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, my goodness, it's the Queen. And along the line she came, and bless her, you know, you could see various presenters, this same scenario happening to them where suddenly they go, oh my goodness, this is the Queen. And Liz Barker, who I presented with, she'd been asked to just give the Queen a very little story about how she'd taken a group of school kids on an anniversary visit to the concentration camp Auschwitz. Very powerful film. And Liz was just going to very quickly tell the Queen that she'd done this and Blue Peter made an amazing film about it. And poor old Liz, obviously, the nerves have got better to her. So as Steve Hawking said, and this is Liz Barker, and Liz just blurted out, I've been to Auschwitz. and the Queen just sort of went, oh, how lovely, and moved straight on. And then eventually it gets to me. And thankfully, I didn't mess up at this point. So I just said to the Queen, I said, Your Majesty, on behalf of the programme, we'd like to give you the programme's highest award. It's a gold Blue Peter badge, and you might be interested to know you can get into the Tower of London free with this. And she chuckled. So I got a laugh out of the Queen, albeit a short one, gave her the gold Blue Peter badge, and off she went. And yeah, it was just one of those really surreal moments in life. And to make the Queen laugh, albeit a short chuckle, you know, you don't forget moments like that. I mean, in terms of Sky, I mean, presenting the 2015 playoff final in the Championship, because it featured my team Norwich against Middlesbrough, you know, one of the hardest things to present in terms of remaining neutral,
but
to be at Wembley on the pitch in the tunnel as you see your team run onto the pitch to celebrate and you follow them to get interviews is a moment I'll never forget. But I think of all the things I've done there, I think going to South Africa to do the 2010 World Cup with Ed Chamberlain was just amazing. We were in Cape Town for 6 weeks. England were dreadful. But aside from that, just you know, being in Africa for a World Cup and particularly being in South Africa was an unforgettable experience. So I think those are the two I'd pick out.
Excellent. I mean, they're great. And I just love the one about the Queen there. I'm now just picturing the Queen that she had to go through the TV guide to be like, yeah, I want to meet these two. These two programmes and who I like.
But she didn't choose EastEnders. So
no, she goes to get out of square miss.
So I think probably, would you say that was probably the most unexpected thing to happen within your job role, meeting the Queen then as well? So that's our next question. So
and the most unexpected thing? No, because that had been there for a while. I think if you talk about unexpected experiences, I was very lucky to film in the Solomon Islands in 2002. And one of our directors, Alex Leger, had worked out there in a voluntary year many, many years before. And we went to film on these incredible islands that are kind of a three-hour flight sort of northeast of Brisbane in Australia. So it's about as far away from the UK as you can get. They're up kind of near Fiji, that kind of area. The most stunning islands. If you ever sort of picture in your mind what a perfect desert island looks like, some of the islands we would go past on this boat look like that. And we were on this boat for 2 weeks and on this boat with this amazing Christian brotherhood called the Melanesian Brotherhood, an amazing group of men who go around to different islands. They're evangelists. And we followed them around for 2 weeks. So actually the two films we made had a really strong Christian ethos. And that's what I loved about Blue Peter, that you were actually able to be on a program where you could speak about your faith and do a film like that. And on one of the islands we went to, we were interviewing the last remaining pagan priest in the whole of the Solomon Islands. So we arrived at this island. The only way to get there off this bigger boat was on these wooden narrow canoes that you've probably seen on various travel programs. And to the island we went. It was a tiny island. You could walk from the top to the bottom of the island in probably 5 minutes. So yeah, that's how small it was. It was a really small island. Only about 30 people lived on it. And on this island was this one remaining pagan priest. And so we walked to this little wooded glade right at the tip of the island next to the sea. Not a very big area of woodland. And into this area we walk. And as we walk through the trees, I can see him sat there. And he's on this kind of big sort of tree trunk that's lying on the ground. And then there's this strange wooden box that turned out to be the tabernacle. And as we're walking through this wood, sort of aiming towards where this pagan priest is sat waiting for us, I'm looking around me and everywhere there's just bones. And I'm assuming, obviously, they're animal bones. But as I look more and more, I'm realizing that these are not animal bones. These are human remains. There are skulls everywhere. And it was one of the most sort of breathtaking in the kind of bad way moments. It's yeah, like, what is this? And as we sat down and talked with him, and obviously Blue Peter filmed it very kind of sensitively in terms of the audience we were talking to. And these were basically his ancestors. And I can't remember the actual ins and outs of the stories, but, you know, inside the box thing, the tabernacle, was the remains of the last pagan priest. And this was a place of huge spiritual significance for this pagan priest. And for him, it's very normal to have the remains of his ancestors strewn throughout the wood.
Yeah.
And I remember the end of it, because he was actually quite a normal guy. I don't know what I expected, but he was quite chilled out, but he didn't speak a word of English. So through the translator, I could gather he was quite chilled out. So I just said at the end, I said, via the interpreter, I said, is there any way I can have a picture with one of his relatives? And he asked, and the pagan priest sort of laughed and just nodded. And he said, yeah, of course you can. I wish I had it now. I just momentarily last night thought, where is it? I just couldn't find it. But I've got this picture literally like that. And I'm sort of looking like that with a skull. Wow. And most people have ever showed it to go, yeah, good joke, skull. I said, no, this was one of the pagan priest's ancestors. I don't know which one, but it was. So that was definitely one of those moments where you just go, A, how blessed and lucky am I to be getting to do a job that takes me to somewhere where most people will never, ever go. Mm. And then to film something as kind of arresting as that, and seeing a very, very different culture, as about as far away from our culture as you can get, was incredible.
Wow. That's I'm just trying to take it all in with that story. That's amazing.
There were a lot of bones to take in, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the fact that you asked for a photo with his relatives as well. I think that's genius.
you're never going to get the chance again. It's not likely I'll return to the Solomon Islands and visit a pagan priest. Well, it's now or never. And he seems quite chilled out. So I don't think he's going to be that offended.
He could have done that old Hamlet. Is it Hamlet that they have the skull?
Yes.
Wow. Yes, probably a line, Darren, and that's probably it.
Well, I thought if he's ever seen Hamlet, which strikes me as probably unlikely, he might at that point thought this guy's just taking the mic.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's amazing, though. And it clearly shows, I mean, from anyone that has seen Blue Peter, there was loads of things that you had the opportunity to do and to be able to do things like that, where then people can see it as well. You're experiencing it, but people are also experiencing it with you by watching it on telly, which is amazing. Okay, so I mean, you talked about how you got into your job roles and how you ended up where you were and things like that, but what is one thing you actually wish you'd known before you got into this career? Is there anything that you wish someone had given you advice of, or anything you'd learned beforehand?
Yeah, probably two things. One is, and I think I largely did this. I think I largely did it, but sometimes you needed to remind yourself, and sometimes I wish I'd reminded myself a bit more. And that is just rinse out every moment, because it goes so quickly. Time goes really, really quickly. And those 6 years that I had on Blue Peter, they went like that. And I sometimes think back to those days where, you know, the best jobs in the world, you know, whatever it is, if there are people watching this and they have dreams one day of being a Premier League footballer, even if you got to do that job and you got to play for Man City or Liverpool or whoever, you're still going to have bad days.
Yeah.
Even in that job, you will have bad days. And I had bad days where I'd drive out of television centre after a live show on a Monday or whenever it was, and be cursing and go, oh, it's flipping all, I hate this. You know, it was such a rubbish day. And I was listening to a really good podcast yesterday about how in life sometimes we need to shift our perspective and remind ourselves actually of everything that we do have. And I wish sometimes in those moments I had been able to kind of shift my perspective on those days where I was getting cross because I was having to film on a day where England were playing in a European qualifier or whatever it might be, of shifting that perspective and reminding myself that actually I'm incredibly blessed to be doing this.
Yeah.
There are thousands out there that when I went for the job were wanting exactly the same job and I got it. And I think that's what I would say to, you know, myself now is in those moments where you were getting annoyed or frustrated,
yeah,
shift your perspective and remind yourself that you're really very fortunate to be doing this. You have a job, you have a roof over your head, you have so much, and you have a job that gives you the opportunity to do things that most people will never ever get to do in their lives unless they pay a lot of money. So I wish I'd used that a little bit more. And I think the second thing I'd probably have said, and I think I began to learn this as it went on, is don't take it too seriously. You know, this is not, particularly in the world of football, I think sometimes we took what, you know, it's about professional pride. Yeah, it's about wanting to do the best you possibly can. So when you're presenting a live Premier League game, you want to be the very best. You want to make it as good as you possibly can. And there's nothing wrong with that. But don't take it too seriously. This isn't heart surgery. This isn't saving lives. This is a game of football, and enjoy it. And sometimes I think there was that pressure to kind of get it right, make sure we're the best at what we do. And if you're not careful, the enjoyment factor gets taken away. And actually, you know, don't take those kind of things too seriously. Obviously, there are some things in life we do need to take really seriously. If you're a heart surgeon, you can't be joking around in the theatre. If you're at the controls of an aeroplane, flying passengers to New York, you don't mess around in the cockpit.
No.
But with my jobs, it was like reminding yourself, and I wish I'd reminded myself more, is that this is a great job, but it's not life or death. Just enjoy it more.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I mean, it sounds very similar to being a youth worker, just with all the cool travel. So, yeah.
I mean, the only cool travel we do is what? Dulverton.
I have to drive down to you quite often, mate. That's a 4-hour drive.
That's the only traveling we do for our job. But we are planning, hopefully, next year to do a road trip across the south of the UK.
Oh, lovely.
I mean, mate, it's still not as exciting as some of the places Simon's gone to, is it?
You've got to start somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, next we do that UK, next stop, Europe, and world's your oyster.
Southampton or the Solomon Isles?
I mean, I'll tell you what, to the cinema at Southampton.
And there's the name of the road trip sorted.
Yeah. Oh, dear. But I think with that question, you kind of answered the next one of what advice would you give someone wanting to pursue a career similar to yours then, I would say.
Yeah, and I think we've touched on it already. You've kind of drawn it out, some of the things I'd say. I think I always say to people the most important thing is perseverance, because there are very few Matt Bakers out there for whom it will happen like that. They're just in the right place at the right time and everything falls into place really quickly. Yeah. They are one-offs. Most people, like talking about Bronwyn earlier, most people, it's about hanging in there. And there are plenty of times when I was working in Selfridges Monday to Friday on Oxford Street selling suits in a job that I enjoy because I had good banter with the guys I worked with, all of a similar age and trying to get on to do bigger jobs. But we had fun, but you were like sitting there or standing there most of the time trying to flog another Hugo Boss suit and thinking, God, is this ever going to happen? And then doing a runner's job for free at the weekend at Children's BBC and getting bacon rolls for directors and presenters. So I ended up, you know, in a couple of years time actually working with. But there were times you just thought, what is the point? You know, this is never going to go anywhere. I'm never going to get to where I want to be. And there were plenty of times I just wanted to throw in the towel and go, this isn't going to happen. And there will be plenty of times for those who are going for jobs or whether it's university or stuff, where you're going to get a knockback. You're going to get a setback. You're going to get a door that closes. But I'd always say to people, once that door closes, there will be another one that will open. It might not be exactly the door you hoped would open, but doors will open. But you have to hang in there. And particularly in this area, but actually I think it applies for lots of areas in life and jobs. You've just got to persevere and don't give up. And, you know, and I'd also say from a faith point of view, absolutely make sure that God's in this, you know, that he is right at the center of everything you're doing, because so often in life we want to go off and do our own thing And then we include God at a later date. We get the interview. It's like, oh, my days, I've got an interview tomorrow. Oh, Lord, please help me, you know, have, find the right words, answer the questions in the right way tomorrow. But we hadn't included them at the start of the story. And I'm glad I did. I'm not saying that if you do that, it means that the opportunity, the job you fix your eyes on is definitely going to happen, because God might have other plans. But include him like I did all those years ago. And so when those moments came, when I thought, this just isn't going to happen, I don't get it, God, I'd remind myself and try and remind myself of that day in July and in 1995, as it was, that was the moment where God said, no, this is where I want you to be. This is where I want you to eventually end up. It took a while. There were lots of twists and turns along the way, but he was right in that. So I'd say perseverance, and from a faith point of view, have God at the center of what you're doing.
Excellent. No, that's really, really good. And a great message to give out as well. Which is really positive. But we want to talk a bit more about your faith in a minute. But just the last thing on your job role is, if you didn't get into a job in TV, what would be your dream job?
That is a good question. And sometimes when, yeah, people ask, well, what would you do next if this didn't work out? I don't know. I think my dream job would have been, I wanted to be an airline pilot.
Nice.
I loved flying. I had this slightly nerdy era that my wife Dorina and friends take the mick out of now, where when I lived in my bachelor days in Wimbledon with a couple of my best mates, I had the Microsoft Flight Simulator on my computer. And I would sometimes get home from Blue Peter and I'd have my tea. I'd sit down at my computer. It was quite rudimentary then compared to the flight simulators you can have on a computer now. It's pretty basic. And I would fly a 747 to New York over the course of the evening. So I'd sit down, I'd set my flight route. I'd got my joystick and stuff. I'd take off from London Heathrow. This is so nerdy. Get to my altitude and then hit autopilot. Leave it for the rest of the evening.
That's amazing.
Wait for the sound, of which was, so I think, air traffic control saying you're this far from New York, and then I'd sit down and land it. And I absolutely loved it. And we did a few flying films on Blue Peter where I actually got to take the control of a couple of different aeroplanes. They were dual seaters. And both times the pilot said, have you flown before? And I'd say, no, but I've got Microsoft Flight Simulator. They go, that's why. I said, it's pretty basic, but actually it teaches you the basics. Mm. It's no substitute, obviously, for being in an actual plane, but it teaches you the basics. And they said, we can tell you've been on. So I go back to it and said, nah, you see, it was worth it. But yeah, I'd love to. I love flight. I absolutely love it. And you know, if I had the money, no object, I'd love to get just my private license, even if it's just a little tiny plane. I'd love to do it, but it's still on my bucket list, so maybe one day it will happen.
That's brilliant. I mean, we laugh about the flight simulator, but the main reason is because Darren, you've just got a flight simulator, haven't you?
Yes.
The thing is, on the Xbox, and it was on the Game Pass, they were giving it away for free, and I was like, oh my goodness, I spent hours doing flights. I was taken off because we've got a few small airports around here. And I was taken off from those airports and then the Heathrow to Australia. I mean, that was a long one.
That's a bit of a long one. Leave it and go to bed and come back the next morning.
I jumped it forward. I had the option of like going forward so many hours so I could get to the landing.
That's cheating.
Yeah. But
that's not proper simulator etiquette.
I mean, this couldn't have worked out perfectly, though. The fact that you brought up flight simulator, this is perfect timing.
My wife, actually, I said to her, I was playing the game, and she's downstairs, and I was like, you know, can you give me 5 minutes? Because I'm just actually landing the plane now.
I can't. I mean, I had to deal with housemates, but I can't imagine Dorina just saying, "Yeah, I'll be down in a minute. I've got to land at JFK," and it's a bit blustery.
Oh, dear.
That is brilliant, though.
And it just with the flight simulator today, you know, it does today's weather as well. It's linked to the weather system, so whatever the weather's like today, it will simulate that within it. So, you know, I was having buckets of fun playing.
I've always wanted to just do the announcement on a plane, and we actually flew to Jersey. Myself and Dorina a couple of weeks ago, and she got really annoyed at me because as we were sat there, I cut my hands together and I start doing announcements like I'm the pilot. and people actually start looking around thinking, is the pilot? And actually on one flight a couple of years ago, we'd been delayed once and we were all sat there waiting for more news. And I just cut my hand and did this announcement, so there'll be a further delay. And the couple across the aisle went, oh, for goodness sake, there's another delay.
I love that. That is brilliant. It's really cool to hear as well, because, you know, they are very different jobs, but also you have experienced a lot of that through the method of the flight simulator, I guess.
Exactly.
I mean, we've touched a lot on your faith throughout this. Obviously, Catalyst Youth UK is a Christian organisation.
Yeah.
We want to reach young people, but also to help their faith grow.
Yeah.
And we met you, when was it, Darren? 2017, I think we worked it out.
Yeah, it came up on the memories on Facebook, I think, the other day. Yeah,
at CVM, which is Christian Vision for Men. And we heard you speak there, and Darren played the worst game of darts in his life against Tim Vine. We won't talk about that one, though.
He's good, Tim.
He is very good. I mean,
I knew him from my team days because we grew up in the same church.
Hmm.
And I had a dartboard. I bought it, and I was really into it. And I had it for about 3 months, and I'd been so close a number of times to that magical 180. But every time you get to the third dart, the moment takes over and you hit one.
Yeah.
And Tim came round one Sunday afternoon and nailed a 180 within about his third set of darts. I remember being gutted because I'd tried for 3 months, and Vine just walks in, third set. There it is.
My uncle's really good at darts. He did a competition once and beat Eric Bristow.
Wow, the crafty cockney.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody's listening to this, there's a lot younger than I.
Yes.
And they won't even know who these people are.
No.
But yeah, I mean, a year supply of beer and a holiday to something like Dawlish Sands or something in a
good grief
in a caravan. I mean, this was
one good for his soul, the other not so good for his liver.
Yeah, it was like a week long. He couldn't do it the whole week, so we got to go as a family to use the final bit of the week. That's my claim to fame. Is that my?
That's a good one. I like that. Christa. Yeah,
I tell you what, though, Dan,
Never rubbed off on me though his skills, because I lost. I think the nerves got to me playing against Tim. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I have just realised, though, that is the next point of contact. We're going to reach out to Tim and see if he can come on and chat about it. But Simon, we heard a bit about your faith at Christian Vision for Men. We heard you talk about your childhood and growing up and the things that impacted you. But what would you say is the most important element of your faith to you?
Gosh, that's a big question.
I apologise, because we did change the question a little bit from the ones we sent you.
No, that's fine. I think what I'd say is the most important part of my faith to me is that I follow a God who never, ever leaves your side, whatever you're going through.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people will be aware I've been through a lot in the last 4 years. And, you know, there were times during the various things that happened to me where you feel that sense that God has somehow abandoned you. Mm. And it kind of comes back to talking what we were talking right back at the start about, you know, that moment in Shawshank Redemption where he's crawling through the dirt to get to freedom. You know, the God that I follow is alongside you in those moments. Mm. When you feel like you are on your own, you've been left to your own devices and you're struggling in life with whatever it might be, whether it's relationships or identity or jobs, whatever it might be, is that the reason why my faith is so important to me is in all of those moments, in the good times and the bad times, you know, we can have friends in life, can't we? You know, maybe some people watching, listening to this, who know those kind of friends who we tend to call them fair weather friends. They're really good friends in the good times when life's good, but then something happens where life just isn't so good anymore. And we find some of those friends falling away. They can't deal with it. They don't know how to support you. They don't know how to find the right words. God never, ever does that. He is always there, whatever's happening. And the challenge for us as Christians is to reach out to God in the good times, because we're all too good at treating God like a bit of a 999 service, that we're just bad, like panicking, where are you, God, I need you.
Yeah.
But actually we should reach out to him daily in the good times as well, when life's good, give him thanks and praise for the where my life is at right now. But it's understanding, as I have, that actually when life is at its very worst, at its most desperate, where you feel as insecure about how the future is going to look as it can possibly be, is to know that actually, even in those moments when you're in the absolute very bottom of the pit, is that God is alongside you even in those moments. He doesn't wait for you to get out of the pit. And I've got an amazing picture here at home We moved house in January. I've still yet to hang it back up, but I can't even remember who it's by. It's reasonably famous, but it's a picture of this point of view where clearly someone is lying in this kind of pool of water and they're struggling to get out. And the picture is of Jesus reaching in with his hand and grabbing this hand to pull them out. And that's the God I follow. That epitomizes who he is that he comes to pull you out. You know, he's there in the good times, but he's also there in the bad times, and he will pull you through. You just have to have faith. And there's going to be those moments like I had where you think, well, where on earth is he? I can't hear him. It feels like he's left me, but actually he's always there. And actually, as you look back in time, you go, no, he was definitely there, and often working through the actions and the words and the love of people.
Mm. Yeah. And I know the exact picture you're talking about. And for anyone listening that would like to see it when this comes out, head over to our Instagram. It will be on there. And I've written it down already, Dan. Right, okay. We won't forget.
The thing is, Simon, we keep promising that, oh, head over to our Instagram and look at this picture, but we keep forgetting to even post them. No, so, you know, we need to get these things right.
Put an alert on your phone.
Yeah. But no, it's a great picture and really comforting one to look at. And that was it was really good to hear that answer, because as we say, we did change that question. You didn't have that one beforehand. So it was very raw, very honest, which is brilliant.
And I mean, it's totally true. You know, I've gone through a lot of rubbish over the past few years, you know, with various things. And it is, you don't feel it at the time. You kind of forget that God is there. But afterwards, when you look back, you go, yeah, he was definitely there, because I am here now.
Yeah.
And look how I am now compared to what I was there. So it's like, definitely. 100% agree with that. So we move on to our final question now of the podcast. And we've kind of reworded it, but I didn't write down the rewording. So I'm just going to...
I will ask the question.
You ask the question, because I'm looking at it now going, I didn't write that down.
But we know, and for anyone listening, you will have heard about this in the past, but Simon, you wrote a book named Love Interrupted. Fantastic book for anyone that hasn't read it. We did, anyone that came to our online youth camp, we did share it on there. But if you haven't read it and want to, please contact Darren or myself. We do have copies that you can borrow. Yeah. But it's a fantastic book and well worth a read. But you also now have a similar podcast called Life Interrupted, where you've had some very recognizable guests, Fern Cotton, Philip Schofield, Tony Bellew, and a whole list of more more episodes than we've done, that's for sure. But why was it important to give this platform to hear from others and to be able to have others share their experience alongside you?
Yeah. Because I think the story of redemption in whatever form that takes is the most powerful story of all. That's ultimately what's at the center of the story of Jesus and of the Gospels. It's the story of redemption for us as people through what he did on the cross and what he went through. And seeing stories from people's lives where they have been in an impossible place, where you think there is no good outcome to this story, and then hearing how they came through the worst of times and the darkest of times and have found life again and embraced life again and gone on to lead a really fulfilled and significant life is an incredibly powerful story. So that's effectively what we wanted the podcast to be about. We wanted to speak to known and unknown people. We'd just been through something life-changing, something that interrupted their life. And we didn't want it to be all about grief. Obviously, Love Interrupted was all about the loss of, you know, my late wife, Gemma, and what that meant for me, what that meant for my boy, Ethan, he was 8 at the time. And how we kind of began to find life again through faith, but also through the love of our friends and our family. And we didn't want the whole podcast to be about grief, because life struggles and interruptions to life come in various different shapes and sizes. So that's what we wanted the podcast to be about, is to be at times a tough listen and to be an uncomfortable listen, but one that ultimately at the end of every episode would leave the listener feeling a sense of hope, feeling actually, no, this guy, this woman has got through something that I can't even begin to imagine how you start again after that. And then you find life again. And Yeah, it's been an amazing experience recording. I think we've done 3 series now, and very rarely am I left at the end of any given interview just feeling anything other than inspired myself, you know, yeah. Just going, wow. So if this person can find life again after what they've been through, we all can. So that was essentially what we wanted to be about. And, you know, ironically, it became very kind of current during COVID, because here we were talking in the podcast about individuals who'd had their life interrupted. Now we were living through a period where every single one of us, to a greater or lesser extent, had had our lives interrupted.
Yeah.
And for lots of people, it meant they were facing a hugely anxious time, which they'd never experienced before. Yet all the people in the podcast I speak to know all about already. Yeah. You know, that feeling of my future's changing. What does this mean for myself, my job, my family, my health? You know, it was a deeply uncertain time. Every single one of us had our life interrupted during that period. So it became, I guess, more relevant than ever. But, you know, just some of the stories that came out of it. And there's one I always reflect upon, and it's easy to pick on the stories of the well-known names, but one of the ones that's always stuck with me came from the first series, and he's a guy called Duncan Slater. And he was an army sergeant, and he had a wife and a daughter, and he was serving in Afghanistan, where obviously we've now pulled out of, and it must leave people like him thinking, well, why were we there? And given what he's gone through, he must feel that even more. But he was in charge of a group of men and women, and their truck was just driving through an area where they knew there were IEDs, landmines. So they knew it was a dangerous route, but they had to make this journey. And very sadly, Duncan's truck hits one of the IEDs and blows up. But where the landmine blows up was directly under the passenger seat where Duncan was sat. Wow. And everyone else on board was just very minor injuries, thankfully. But Duncan ends up a few weeks later, after all other kind of hope is gone in terms of trying to fix his injuries, has to lose both legs. Wow. So he goes through a long period of rehabilitation, a long period of learning how to walk again, but with prosthetic limbs. And very, very dark times he went through at that hospital in Selly Oak, where so many of the injured men and women from serving abroad go and are kind of rebuilt, essentially, in terms of their physical being. But the rebuilding you mentally is probably even harder than rebuilding yourself physically. Yeah. This guy goes through, you know, a horrendously dark time, times when he felt like giving up. But then he begins to tell the story of life ever since. And this is a guy who has gone through one of the worst things most of us can imagine, and yet has gone on to lead this remarkable life, where he became the first double amputee to ski to the South Pole. There's a horrendous event in the Sahara Desert in Morocco called the Marathon de Sable, where you run marathon after marathon after marathon over a series of days in the desert. It is as hard as it comes. He tried it 1 year, and he literally failed the night before because he got horrible infection in between the prosthetic limbs he had and what remained of his legs.
Yeah.
And he couldn't go on because he was near to dying. Did he give up? No, he went back the next year and did it again. And actually, when I interviewed, he was going back again to do it for a second time to raise money for various charities, but COVID then put pay to that. And I was listening to this guy telling his story and going, goodness me, you've been through something utterly life-changing. You've been to the darkest of places, and yet you sound happier and more fulfilled than ever.
Yeah.
So I just thought, I'm going to ask him this question. I wasn't quite sure where it came from, but I thought, I'm just going to ask it anyway. So I said, Duncan, if you could go back to that day in 2014 and change the story of what happened, would you? And you're expecting him to go, cool. I said, oh, my God, that's an impossible question to answer. He answered literally almost immediately, no. And you're like, wow. So you wouldn't go back to a time and change that story to mean you had 2 working limbs? I said, I can't understand. How is that possible you feel like this? He said, because it's taken my life in such a different direction that had that event not happened, I wouldn't have gone on to achieve and do the things that I've achieved that have given me such a sense of purpose and fulfillment and happiness. And, you know, my marriage is now happier than it's ever been, even though we've been through some tough times. My relationship with my daughter is so good. Mm. And I thought, goodness me, there's a lesson for all of us. You know, this is a guy who went through something life-changing, something that would have led others understandably to perhaps even give up on life altogether. Mm. And yet he's saying, I wouldn't change that. I'd still want to go down this route. And that's the podcast in a nutshell. It's about men and women going, you can go through something life-changing. Yeah. You can go to the very bottom of the pit, but there's always a way through. It is, as I describe it, and lots of guests have described it, it's always a narrow way through, but there's still a way through.
Yeah.
And I always say to people who talk to me about being maybe in a similar position to where I was at in 2017 and say, well, where's the hope in all this? I say, there is always a way through. And from a faith perspective, when you've got God walking alongside you, that he will help lead you through that narrow path that then can lead to a life that can be as rich as it ever was before, perhaps richer because of what it's taught you about life and about taking life for granted. And it can, as Duncan's story and other stories we've told in this podcast series, lead you to a more fulfilled life than perhaps the one you had before. And that's that story of redemption, that story of finding hope again is, I think, a really powerful one. So that's why every guest I've interviewed, I've left the end of the interview and thought, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, wow. What we are actually running out of time, but what a way to end the podcast with such an inspiring message. And it, as we say, Life Interrupted, you can find it on Spotify. Is it on other platforms, Simon, as well?
It's on all podcast platforms.
There we go.
I basically say you can find it on Global Player or wherever you find your podcasts.
Notes, there we go. Well, yeah, we will put a link for Life Interrupted in here as well. And as we say, Love Interrupted, if you want to have a read of it, again, contact us or buy yourself a copy. It's a good one to have.
Oh, so, thank you, mate.
So, but it's been an absolute pleasure. Darren, are we okay?
Yeah, sorry. They literally just stopped the doorbell from, you know, ruining the podcast. I had to mute ourselves. But yeah, Simon, it's been amazing to have you with us. And thank you for giving up your time this morning to
pleasure, boys.
Talk to us. And yeah, just to reiterate what Ashley said, Love Interrupted, the book. Make sure you got tissues for the first few chapters because I needed them. Wow, don't read it in bed of a nighttime either because your wife wonders why you're sobbing next to her.
I started reading it on a coach with a bunch of young people on the way back from Soul Survivor and that was a mistake.
Yeah. Amazing book, amazingly written as well. So thank you very much for that and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, boys.
So thanks again to Simon Thomas for joining us today and thank you for you guys for listening. If you've got any questions about this podcast or any of our podcasts or you want to listen to them again, you can head back and listen to all 48?
Sure.
Is there 48 of them, maybe?
Do you want me to check?
I'm guessing at 48. Well, there's 48, I'm guessing.
We'll find out if you're right.
You can contact us via our website at www.catalystyouth.org.uk and you can also email us at info@darren or anthony@catalystyouth.org.uk and then also on our website you can follow all our social media stuff, the Twitter, the Instagram, the Facebook. And
as we say, like head over to YouTube because Darren's story earlier about his prison stint, it's on there.
Yes.
Just to let everyone know, this was episode 49.
Oosh, there you go, 48 before. So as always, it's goodbye from him.
And it's goodbye from him. We'll see you soon.
Cheers.